are going to talk to two authors of a really fascinating book called False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. And it was written by two authors, two journalists who actually won a Pulitzer Prize for their investigation of this fascinating story of a teenager who was raped and then was charged with lying about the rape. Our guests are T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you? Are you both there with me?
Thanks for having us.
Great. I want to give you guys just a little bit more of an introduction because you're so amazingly qualified and have so many good things that you've done. Ken Armstrong is an award-winning journalist with the Seattle Times and the Chicago Tribune, where his work helped prompt our Governor Ryan to commute death sentences and later eventually ending up in the abolishment of the death penalty in Illinois. He's a professor in writing at Princeton and a fellow at Harvard. He has six IRE awards. Which is an investigation, help me with that one.
And investigative reporters and editors.
And editors. Mm-hmm. And Edgar Allan Poe Award and a Peabody Award. Welcome to the show. And then T. Christian Miller, senior reporter with ProPublica. He's a 20-year journalist and foreign correspondent covering four wars, a presidential campaign in 24 countries. You have Emmy Awards and Pulitzer Prize for this reporting. You guys... Interesting story. How did you both come to the story? How did you first come to know that this was a story you wanted to report? And maybe start with Ken.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
It's interesting. We both came to this story separately. We did not begin working on it together. I live in Seattle, and Marie, the woman who was raped and not believed, she at the time was in Lynnwood, which is just north of Seattle. I was familiar with the fact that she had filed a lawsuit against Lynnwood, alleging that they had failed to protect her, basically, that they had fumbled the investigation when they concluded that she had lied about the case. I began looking at it because I was hoping that she would speak to her personal experience about what she had gone through in this case. And I was also hoping to reconstruct how the investigation in Lynnwood had gotten it so wrong. You know, how did they first begin to doubt her, and how did those doubts spread?
That's what
I wanted to look at.
And let's go to what happened here. T, if you can just maybe give us some background on what happened to Marie on that day, and then what happened afterwards that led to her being prosecuted.
Sure. So Marie was sexually assaulted in her apartment in Lynnwood, Washington, as Ken was saying. She reported that to police immediately. A neighbor called 911. The police responded. They began investigating the case very much as a rape case. But what happened is one of Marie's foster parents began to have some doubts about whether or not the incident had occurred. And it arose from kind of a natural common mistake, which is that the foster mother didn't believe that Marie was acting the way that a rape victim should act. And we know from studies and from lots of work out in the field that there is no way, single way to act or anything that kind of predicts that this person is a victim and the other person is not a victim. Mm-hmm. But that was enough to make the police begin to doubt some of Marie's stories, too. And eventually they brought her in, and she signed a series of different statements, confessions, after being subjugated to some interrogation by the police about whether or not she was telling the truth. So at the end of where our story began to pick up steam is the police eventually charged her with making a false report to the police department. And that for the police in Lynnwood, that was the end of the story. Where I came in, where I met Ken in doing the story, is I had been working on stories about how police and prosecutors don't do a good job in investigating rape. And one of my sources said, go look at this great job that was done in Colorado by a bunch of police in Colorado. And that's where, when I was interviewing these police, they had done a magnificent job in tracking down a serial rapist. And at the end of that, when they arrested the serial rapist, they were looking through the photos he had taken and the attacks, and they discovered a picture of Marie in Lynnwood. And so at that point in time, they were able to tell the police in Lynnwood, this is not a case of false reporting. Marie was raped. She had been raped.
So here she goes through this rape. It wasn't, not that it matters, but it's a stranger who comes into her home, ties her up, takes pictures of her, subjects her to rape over a period of time. She tells everybody about it. She changes her story due to whatever, maybe pressures put on by the police officers, maybe just her emotional state. We don't know. And she was prosecuted for it and actually pled guilty, did she not?
Yeah, she accepted a plea deal under which the conviction would be thrown out after a year if she met certain conditions. She needed to be on probation for a year. She needed to pay $500 in court costs. And she needed to get counseling, not for being raped, but for lying about being raped.
So, again, let's go back to the issue of rape. There is a thought, it just seems, that when women accuse men of rape, there's a higher standard. There's a higher standard of what were you doing, what time was it, why were you out, what, and you would never ask a victim of burglary or robbery, why were you out at 2 o'clock in the morning, why were you drinking, are you sure that your stuff was really taken? It's just not how the investigation goes. But in rape investigations, maybe just generally, what do you see as being the wrong line of questioning? And T, maybe you can go on this one.
Sure. And Karen, you're playing out kind of the long history of skepticism that exists in our legal system, as you know. And that's just, it's been very difficult for both prosecutors and investigators in some cases to kind of get over this idea that the woman had some role in the decision by a rapist to rape or attack her, right? So the best practices these days is that the police investigators practice is to not come in with a lot of bias and conceptions about what it is that a rape should look like, what a rape victim should look like, what a rape scene should look like. And the idea is listen to the victim and then verify and follow up what they say. That's one of the police in our book who spoke to us. Her advice was you listen to what the victim says and then you corroborate that evidence and you work very hard to kind of suspend whatever your own biases may be and just look at the facts and where do the facts take you.
One of the things that your book really hits home on is you touched upon this. There is no victim mentality. You know, this was a girl who was in 20 foster homes. She had been sexually and physically abused throughout the process. She was a survivor, it seems, and it seems that she's still a survivor. And a person like that may or may not react the same way that somebody else who didn't have that experience would react. And it was interesting to me that the people who were closest to her, largely the foster parent, was skeptical. And I found that just really sad, that the person who supposedly loved her the most was the one who kind of brought to the attention of the police that she may not be telling the truth. What do you make of that?
Right. Marie did have a history of sexual abuse tracing back to her childhood, and people with a history like that are more likely to shut down when it happens again. And in her case, two of her foster mothers simply didn't understand her lack of affect after she reported being raped. She seemed emotionally detached. She didn't seem to be hysterical or crying. They didn't understand all kinds of things that she was doing in the immediate aftermath. She wasn't making eye contact. She didn't hug them. All of these things they interpreted skeptically, and that skepticism was then communicated to the police department and incorporated by the detectives, you know, who are in charge of the investigation. And it's true. I think that with both of the foster mothers, they have genuine affection for Marie. And I think that shows how deeply ingrained these misconceptions can be when those people who are even close to you and affectionate towards you misinterpret those signals. That tells you how commonly that can happen.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking about a great book called False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. And we're talking to the authors T. Kristen Miller and Ken Armstrong. Let's take a break and we'll come back and talk more. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, a book that you should read. It's very, very interesting. The research behind it resulted in an article that won the Pulitzer Prize for these two authors I have on tonight, T. Kristen Miller and Ken Armstrong. Thank you again for joining us. This is a case where a teenager was raped. She recanted, but it really happened to her. It was proven that it happened to her, and she was falsely prosecuted for lying to the police officers. The guy who was the perpetrator, and the book isn't really much about the perpetrator. It's more about the victim and how this investigation went wrong. But this guy was a serial rapist. And Ken, can you tell us a little bit about this guy and what his background was?
Sure. He was raised in Colorado and went into the military after 9/11. And he said that he realized from a very early age, from the time he was 5 years old, that there was something wrong with him. He traces it to seeing one of the Star Wars movies.
That was astounding, that he was watching that at age five and somehow came up with some fantasy about enslaving women.
That's right. When he saw Princess Leia, you know, chained up in Jabba the Hutt's lair, he said that that triggered in him fantasies, and that for the rest of his adolescence and adulthood, it's something that he was wrestling with, this feeling that, you know, he needed to see fear in women. What's interesting is, you know, T and I were able to interview him in Colorado, and it was clear that he had studied rape, that he had figured out the ways in which rape is investigated and how he could avoid being caught. He would destroy DNA. He avoided fingerprints. He encrypted electronic files. When we talked to him, he described himself as being proficient at rape. That's the word he used, proficient. And he had this entire vocabulary about rape that was militaristic and dehumanizing. He would talk about how he would seek out a target-rich environment, to use his words. It was chilling talking to him because you realize that this was someone who he had in his possession the rape investigation handbook. He knew what police do and what they don't do. He would not commit. He would move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction when he was committing these assaults because he knew that police have a reputation of not cooperating with one another. So he figured that the patterns that he was establishing would not be picked up if he simply kept moving from county to county or city to city.
And I suppose that is the reason that he was successful at being a serial rapist. Had he not been disorganized, had he not been cognizant of getting caught and being one step ahead of the police, this may have been a one and done. But this guy was, as you say, methodical. And what I found slightly interesting was that he didn't really come from a family where there was trauma. He was married at some point. He was intelligent. That doesn't surprise me, I suppose. But he didn't come from a background where you would say, I could see that coming. Was that at all surprising to you, either of you?
Well, one of the things is that we have relied mostly on the serial rapist's name is Mark O'Leary. Our interview with Mark O'Leary and his interviews in court when he talks about his family background. So, you know, he is a convicted serial rapist. He may or may not have a reason to have look at his background with different eyes than maybe somebody else who is looking at it. So, yes, he certainly says that he came from a loving family, that he always felt like this was something that he had to hide from his family. And we are fairly certain that his family didn't know exactly about what was happening until he actually stood up and made a confession in court. So he was very practiced and skilled, as Ken said, not only at hiding this crime from the cops, but hiding it from everyone in his life. His wife had no idea that he was sort of sneaking around at night, stalking women. He would spend hundreds of hours outside apartment complexes looking for victims that he could attack. So he was definitely somebody who was adept at hiding just who he was.
You know, I have a theory, and I'm not sure if it plays out in this case, but it seems to me that people who are predators, like this guy was obviously a predator, kind of knows his prey. And I have seen over the years where women who maybe aren't going to be believed because they're drunk or because they have psychological issues or because they're somehow perceived as being weak, that the predators will pick up on that somehow and know instinctively that those are the people they go after. Did you get any of that sense from this guy?
Well, from this guy, he developed a checklist. So in general, Karen, both Ken and I are covered cops for, of course, for many years, and it's not a mystery that that occurs, that rapists sort of seek out women in vulnerable positions as victims and groom them for attack. In his case in particular, though, it was almost a challenge to him to attack these women and to achieve his goals. So he would have a very sort of like kind of a checklist he would go through. He would look for women who were single, first of all. He preferred women who lived by themselves in houses instead of apartment complexes, because apartment complexes have a lot more eyes around them. He would never attack a dog in the house because he basically scared that the dog might attack him or sound the alarm. So he had a very kind of a checklist on him. And some of it's not necessarily like an emotional checklist, but sort of a physical safety checklist he would go down before he would select his victims.
Let's talk about the statistics. From the best research that you've done, what is the statistic on how many women falsely accuse men of rape? Because it sounds, when you hear these kinds of issues come up, you would think it happens all the time. What is your best stat on that?
So the statistics, any statistics about sexual assault, it is a very difficult time, crime report to investigate, are to be taken with a little bit suspicion. The standard figure you'll hear is that 2% to about 8% of false reports are provably false. In other words, 2 to 8% of the rapes that do get reported, which is not all of them, can be shown to be actually false. This isn't like an assumption that a cop makes or a prosecutor makes. This is where they've gone out and they've looked and they found, yes, indeed, there's no way that this sexual assault occurred. And that's about 2% to 8%. The number could be higher than that because most false report allegations don't get investigated in the same way that most rape allegations don't get investigated. So that's the number you hear. But just keep in mind that any number with sexual assaults tends to be somehow obscured by the stigma which surrounds the crime itself.
Now, this Me Too movement, it's kind of a timely time to have a book out like this, obviously. And as you watch this whole thing unravel, what was your thought about the parallels between what happened to Marie and what happened in this case with all these women who are now coming forward, especially in the Hollywood arena?
It seems with what's at the heart of the Me Too movement is this frustration with not being heard, with having reports of harassment or worse, be minimized or discounted. And Marie's experience exemplifies that, captures that in about the most tragic way possible. You know, if Marie wasn't heard, if she wasn't believed, here's a woman who was attacked at knife point in her home by a stranger, a woman who had bruises on her wrist, who went to the hospital for an exam, who cooperated with police every step of the way. If she isn't heard, if she isn't believed, how much faith can others have who come forward?
Absolutely. I think that rings loud and clear. I want to thank you both for coming on, T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong, the authors of False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. How can people pick up your book?
Amazon, all major bookstores, independent booksellers, Barnes & Noble. I should be able to find it hopefully everywhere.
And what does a Pulitzer Prize look like? Just asking. What does it look like?
A small block of Tiffany glass.
All right. Now I know. Not that I'm ever going to get one, but I can always hope. Thank you so much for joining us on this cold night in Chicago. Good luck with your book and have a good Valentine's Day.